Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He is a gold expert. His name is Mark Yaxley. Mark, welcome back to the show, my friend.
George, good to be back with you.
Okay, so I've been starting off the last few interviews by asking my guests what they have actually been thinking about the last couple of weeks, because the world is a crazy, crazy, crazy place right now. Obviously, from a social standpoint in the United States, I got some just unbelievable things happening right now, but also the gold market, precious metals, the stock market, cryptocurrency, meme stocks. Should I go on?
Those are all things I'm thinking about. Like you said, it's a crazy world. There's just so much to try to process these days.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you think is most important for people to think about, or what have you been doing in your personal life right now? Let's start macro, then work our way down.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, professionally, you know, everything kind of funnels back to gold and silver for me, but on the personal side, inflation is definitely top of mind for me. I mean, this is something that impacts everybody, not just bankers and Wall Street brokers. This is dinner table conversation these days, and it impacts all of us. So I think that's really relevant. I'd, you know, love to share my thoughts on that with you.
Yeah, now I want to point out that you're in Canada right now.
I'm in Canada right now. I'll give you the Canadian perspective today. Yes.
Yeah, how is inflation there? Is it similar to what we've been seeing in the United States?
Definitely. I mean, you talk to people on the street, everyday people doing their holiday shopping, you know, grocery shopping, and people are talking about it. And these aren't investors. Mm-hmm. These are just, you know, normal middle-class people, and they're concerned about it as well. And obviously for those of us who pay closer attention to the market, it's something that's really concerning to me.
Is it being picked up in the media?
Definitely. Yeah. There is pressure, I'd say politically, from the Conservative Party here in Canada on Justin Trudeau. But Justin, you know, he just floats above all that. Justin, you know, he doesn't recognize that spending at record clips is a problem at all. In fact, he said publicly that he will spend whatever he has to, you know, to keep things going and moving forward, and obviously blaming everything on COVID and doing it all in the name of COVID. So it's similar to the United States, I'd say, generally speaking.
Well, Biden takes it so far as to say the more government spending we have, that'll actually cure inflation.
Really? Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I'd like to understand how that works.
Well, I guess I'll try to give him the benefit of the doubt here. I think his argument, if you want to call it that, is that if they pass a $2 trillion infrastructure bill, mm-hmm. That infrastructure will ease the supply chain disruptions and therefore will decrease supply shortages and therefore bring prices back to an equilibrium. So the more government spending, if it's kind of directed in that manner, that should ease inflationary pressures. Now, you know, and I know different, but that's kind of his argument.
You know, it's really interesting. The government, the people that put us in this position in the first place, both inflation and supply chain issues, and now they've kind of bundled the two together. You know, they put us in the position, they lied to us about it. Now they're the ones that are going to fix it. So I find that really interesting. I'd love to share my thoughts on that with you today as well. You know, first of all, they lied to us about the rate, the actual inflation rate. They said, oh, it's going to be slightly higher than 2%. It's going to be slightly higher than the target. Don't worry about it. It's transitory. That's like a 6-month window, guys. It's all good. And now they come out and say, well, actually it's like the CPI is like 3 times higher than the inflation target. And that's not even the real inflation rate.
Right.
And now they're like, oh, you're looking at a 12 to 18 month window. It's probably going to be longer than that. So first, you know, they misinform us. You know, they lie to us blatantly publicly. And then these are the same people that are going to fix the problem for us. They create it, they lie, and now they're going to fix it. So, you know, maybe if Joe says it's true, it's true. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd like to understand, or maybe better understand, the definition of transitory. So, I mean, how long can we go on? 4 years, 5 years, 10 years. And it's still transitory if it stops after that. And I think it's important that people understand how inflation usually works. And if you look at the decade of the 1940s and the 1970s, you saw huge spikes of inflation. The 1940s, it got as high as 19%. And then it'll be in that range for a couple of years, and it'll come crashing down to, in the 1940s, it actually went to deflation at the end of the 40s. But it never happens in a straight line. But even if you do have a period of a year of, let's say, deflation where prices are actually going down, they still go up to this high water mark, right? So prices are still astronomically high and far exceed the rate of wage gains, even if the inflation in of itself is quote unquote transitory.
Yeah, wage gains always follow inflation. So there'll be a lag time, you know, for the average person, it could be as long as a year, which is completely unfair. In the meantime, you know, anyone on fixed income, on a fixed salary, you know, they're losing right now. And, you know, that's something that we should all be concerned about. But I think, you know, tying back to gold, you know, historically, gold's been kind of thought of a hedge against inflation. Only the last couple of years, that hasn't really happened. And instead, inflation has found its way into the equity markets. If you look at the Fed's balance sheet growth since 2020 and the S&P 500, the correlation is almost 1-to-1. Yeah, right. So basically, a lot of that stimulus money and basically 0% interest rates, a lot of that benefit has gone into the equities market. It hasn't really found its way into the commodity prices or gold specifically. So that's a little bit different. But I think for gold investors, they have to wait a little while longer. We're going to have to see once interest rates actually start to go up and the tapering, if it happens. Now they say tapering, they're going to, you know, the bond tapering is going to start soon, but there's a massive stimulus package pending approval right now. So there's going to be stimulus in other forms, finance way into the economy, which is the general playbook for the federal government in the United States. But I really think once we see interest rates rise and we see some sort of tapering happening, I really would expect the equity markets to come off. And I expect at that point, gold should do what it does, which is rise in value when equities come off.
Yeah.
But I think people have to wait and see a little bit longer.
What's interesting is I don't know if rates will rise if they just taper alone. Because if you look at that chart of the Fed's balance sheet, and then you juxtapose that to a chart of the 10-year yield, there's an inverse correlation. It's completely counterintuitive. And this goes back to the GFC. I don't know what it did prior to that, or what it did maybe in the 1940s, but you look at the Fed's balance sheet, it goes up. Therefore, they're buying the long end of the curve. They're buying more bonds, but yet interest rates actually go up. And then once they start QT, then the interest rates actually go down. We saw that in 2020 when they took the quantitative easing up to $120 billion a month. Rates have actually gone up since then. So I don't know if that means or has any predictive power. But we could see an environment where they're decreasing the rate of quantitative easing, let's say, or maybe even going into quantitative tightening, but rates are actually going down as a result.
You know, at this point, I think they've backed themselves into a little bit of a corner. And, you know, it was interesting this morning's news, obviously, being that Powell got tapped for a renewal on his term. And I was trying to interpret exactly what that meant. You know, this person or you know, his agency is partially responsible for the inflation issue that we're dealing with now. And so you'd think if they didn't nominate him for a second term, they would have had to admit basically publicly that things aren't working. But instead, they tap him and say he's doing a great job. You know, he's cured the unemployment issue. And they didn't really comment on the inflation problem. They actually said that they've attained their inflation target, which was 2%. Not only have they attained it, they've blown it out of the water.
Yeah, right.
You know, so it's funny how they word these things and really don't give the public the whole story. But it was interesting this morning, him getting that nomination for a second term. And I think it's really Biden saying, we can't admit we're wrong yet. Let's kick this can down the road a little bit longer. Let's see if we can pull one out of the hat. But I don't see that happening personally at this point.
I think that's always been their game plan, just to try to kick the can down the road. They know that they're backed into a corner. I think the economy has been completely financialized. And it's really dependent. I think the purchasing power of the average American is really dependent upon a 401k or their home equity, or now I think increasingly cryptocurrencies. And I think the central planners know that. So they're doing everything they can to try to continue to blow air into the bubbles, because at the end of the day, that is the real economy when you've got 70% consumption, you know, because consumption is so tied to asset prices instead of being tied to productivity. And, you know, unfortunately, it doesn't end well, but they'll continue to kick the can down the road and just hoping that some sort of magic happens between now and then and they get out of this. It, you know, it's a lot. I always look at it like a heroin addict. and the only cure for the heroin addict is just to take away the, let's say, the monetary heroin in this case. And you've got two options. You know, either you continue to give the addict heroin and they get closer and closer to their death, they become more and more unhealthy, or you take away the heroin and they go through these massive withdrawals. And that's, I think, our economy. They're just giving it more and more heroin, hoping that scientists or whatever magically come up with some sort of cure for a heroin addict in the interim. That's kind of the game we're playing right now.
Exactly. It's funny. I was having the same thought preparing for the show, and I'm like, can I say that, you know, in front of George's audience? Can we talk about a drug addict? And basically, I agree 100%.
Yeah.
But the end game is, you know, an overdose or a lifelong addiction, which seems to be the case. That's kind of the culture, not necessarily that the average person wants, but the culture that the government has created for us in today's economy in Canada and the United States, that they have ultimate control. First of all, we have no control anymore. We've handed over the reins in terms of our financial freedom for most people. And I think it's so important that we start to take that back. Like, if there's one thing that private individuals can do to fight what's happening to them right now, is to try to take back their personal financial freedoms as much as possible. Gold plays into that. Cryptocurrency plays into that. You know, building wealth and independence from needing the government in your life plays into that. And then you have the ideology of, you know, yeah. And I can't believe some people still believe this, because I know you and I do not believe this at all, but the ideology that somehow the government's going to do it better for us than we can do it for ourselves, right, that somehow we should trust them with these huge decisions that are life altering for us, because somehow they're smarter than us and they know what's best for us. And I just don't think that's working anymore. And unfortunately, a lot of people either don't talk about that, it's not important in their lives, they just kind of go on with the way things are. But I think, you know, to get away from centralized planning, which is a theme I know you've been hitting a lot, I've been listening to your interviews, I really love it. It really taps into my kind of day-to-day thinking as well. I think people need, number one, create that financial independence as much as you possibly can for yourself and for your family. And two, break away from this ideology that the government is out for our own best interests, and they're going to do what's in our best interests all the time. They've proven over and over again that's not the case. And they're proving it right now with inflation. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I think a lot of it, just from a personal standpoint, involves unplugging from all of the noise, if you will. Before we started recording, you're telling me about your personal situation up in Canada. Do you want to go into that, in that town where you live? And, sure. You know, you're saying how it just helps you, number one, enjoy life because life's short, but number two, just get out of this whirlwind of insanity, and it helps you ground you, and it allows you to think and really focus on what's important and then make better, or hopefully better, financial decisions in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think so, George. And it's not for everybody. I'm not going to sit here and say I'm a lifestyle guru. I'm not a life coach by any means. I work too much. You know, I'm not a perfect husband. I've got my faults. But when it came to choosing where we lived, I think we nailed it. We live in a town in the Rocky Mountains in Canada. It's a town of 6,000 people. So we were talking about COVID earlier and the impacts of COVID and the impacts of kind of government's plans and how they're dealing with things and lockdowns. And life in our little town hasn't changed that much. You know, people here have remained friendly. They've remained courteous. You know, we can still go to the restaurants. We can still go to the bars. You know, we enjoy most freedoms that we had before COVID. Whereas, you know, 2.5 hours down the road in Calgary, Alberta, which is a city of about 1.3 million people, it's a much different story. And when you speak to people, they look, you know, rather unhealthy or depressed, or, you know, and I'm not saying all Calgarians are unhappy, don't get me wrong, but it's a much different situation. So I think if you ever have the opportunity to live in a small place and have a little bit of acreage and have the ability to grow a garden and do all those simple things, I know, you know, a lot of these people and you live according to this lifestyle, but I do have a lot of mentors that have their own acreage that are able to provide for their families in worst case scenarios. And I think COVID kind of proved that way of thinking, it doesn't make you some sort of conspiracy theorist. It actually makes you a very wise person to go against the curve. And there's a great quote I was reading a little bit before the interview that Mark Twain, you know, said. He said, if you find yourself on the side of the majority, it's time to pause and reflect. And it's for me, it's one of those things. It's just like, do I want to be like everyone else and follow the government's leader? Do I want to break away and try and do it my own way? And maybe I'll be wrong at the end of the day, but I think it's been healthy for myself and for my family to undertake that whole kind of lifestyle mission.
Yeah. You know, I firmly believe in that quote, or, you know, just another, said another way, when everyone's on one side of the boat, you probably want to go to the other side of the boat. And that's what worries me about my stance on inflation, because I believe that inflation is not transitory. And it, see, I should define that term, because that's where it gets very complex. I think people just throw that out there and without really understanding what it means. So when I say that I don't think inflation is transitory, what I am saying is that we've got, I think we'll have big spikes of inflation, and then the rate of inflation will come back down based on government spending until we get a central bank digital currency. So you could see, let's say this year it's based on the CPI. Let's say it's at 7%. Next year it's at 11. Then it goes back down to maybe 5, or maybe it goes back down to 4. And then the government starts spending some more money. Then it goes back up to 8, and then it goes up to 10, and then it goes back down to, you know, maybe 3 or something like that. This is very consistent with what we saw throughout the 1970s and the 1940s. So I don't, but what I don't believe is, I don't think we'll go through 2 or 3 years like we did at the end of the 40s, where we have actual deflation as measured by the CPI, where we have a negative print there. I don't see that happening. So I don't know what, you know, what stance, if that means that I believe there's a secular inflation, or I don't believe that it's transitory, or I do believe it's transitory because it's not going up in a straight line, but that's really my view. And when I kind of look on social media and in the normal media, mainstream media, like we were saying, you know, a lot of people, I think, have that same view, and that makes me worried. That potentially, you know what I'm saying? So how do you kind of reconcile that in your own head?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, so you're really describing kind of inflation volatility, where it's not a linear relationship. Yeah. You know, I, you know, I'm not going to sit here and claim that I'm an expert on inflation. Certainly not. I'm an expert on gold. And so I'm always just trying to tie it back to what the impact is going to be on gold and silver investors. But
you know what it seems like to me, Mark? It seems like, I don't want to say that's an exception to the rule, but it seems like it could be, just because psychology is such a big component of inflation, right? So meaning that the more people that are on that one side of the boat, the higher the probability is that we see continued inflation. The more people that believe there's going to be inflation, the higher probability that we actually see continued inflation, because it changes people's consumer behavior. Do you think maybe there's something to that?
Definitely. Well, it's interesting. Now we're getting really deep into kind of human psychology, but I don't want to go way off topic here, but remember that all these things that we're talking about are all created by man. All of these ideas, all these concepts of, you know, the economy, inflation, how we control inflation, this is all made up. This is all derived from human minds. This is not something that was on Earth when we got here, when it all started. This is not a naturally occurring thing. This is a human thing.
Yeah, Moses didn't get it from the top of Mount Sinai.
Right. And it's funny, like, we live in a world now where all of our problems are self-made problems. Like, we've created all of these problems, all these stresses, all these complexities are all man-made. So I think, you know, going back to what we were talking about before, living in a small town, it's moving away from complexities that are man-made and created, right, and trying to move back to simplicity. I think so many people are craving that right now. See a lot of that. I see a lot of people from the city moving out to the country, trying to get some, you know, small acreage to do that kind of thing. But going back to what you said, I would tend to believe that. I think that human nature is such that once we kind of see that message presented in front of us many, many times over, we'll tend to actually reenact what's being described to us, because it becomes our norm, you know, and that goes back to the quote. It's like, when that becomes the norm for the majority of people, you need to stop and think, why is this becoming the norm? Why am I allowing this to happen? Or why is it happening? And reflect on it. So yeah, I think you're probably right. That's pretty deep though. I don't know.
I don't know. My mom texted me the other day. My mom's like 82 years old and she lives in Vegas. And she sent me a text the other day saying that she was stocking up on food, just because she's concerned that, you know, the stuff that's non-perishable, like canned goods and whatnot, not for like bug out or anything, but because she thinks the prices are going to be a lot higher in 6 months. So she's just stocking up now. And again, that's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If more people are out there buying and buying, that's additional demand, with the same amount of supply or less supply because of these supply chain disruptions and bottlenecks and whatnot. And therefore mm-hmm. that creates the increase in prices that she was worried about in the first place.
Yeah, you're right. That's a perfect everyday example of what you're describing. And yeah. I like how you simplified that. It's true. And seeing the same thing here in Canada. It's, I was standing at the grocery store yesterday with my wife, just buying, you know, Sunday goods. And the guy behind us is asking the cashier if they're running out of stock. Like, are people overbuying? And I forget what they called it. They have a term for this, but they're like, are they buying up all the toilet paper? Are they buying up all the canned goods?
And prepping or something.
She's like, yes, they are, you know? And we're like, I was thinking to myself, like, why? Like nothing. If you look at the shelves themselves, they're fully stocked. The lady said, we receive 6 trucks a week. That's 6 days out of 7. There's a truck from Calgary or Edmonton that's delivering, you know, food and goods to these shelves. And yet people are panicked. They're into this. They're buying into the media and they're just going out and loading up and getting as much.
Fascinating. Here in Phoenix, Mark, which is obviously a major metro area, most of the grocery stores that I've been to over the last couple months, they have supply shortages. So like you go in there and the shelves are not fully stocked. I would say they're maybe 80%, 85%. Like I know there's a Whole Foods right across the street where I always go. And the water section is like half empty. Like, and I know this because there's one brand of water that I always get and they haven't had it in stock in like probably 2 months. So you are seeing it reflected in the grocery stores here in the United, or at least in my area of the United
States. In certain markets. Yeah. And you're right. And I shouldn't just generalize because in our small market here, our supply chain is working.
Yeah.
You know, our shelves are full.
The small city, the supply chain's working, but the big city, it's not. It's kind of.
Right. Well, the big city, the problem, one of the issues about living in the big city is it's much more fragile supply chain. You have so many people that are reliant on the same supply of food and goods and services that obviously the impact there is going to be major. It's going to be major when there's a problem and that will create social disruption, which, you know, can lead to all kinds of problems. Like, you know, you guys had an example just recently in the United States, everybody's talking about, but that kind of issue can come from, you know, not having their basic needs met. So it's interesting. It's a fragile, it can be quite brittle. And another reason, you know, consider living in a place where you can get away from some of that, but you know, we're off topic, but lifestyle is important to me at least. And I know to a lot of your viewers, it would be as well.
Yeah. The chance of getting mowed down by an SUV in your little town in the Rockies is probably pretty low.
Pretty low. Yeah. Pretty low.
But you know, on that note, or, you know, whatever is going through the news here that people, I think, understand what we're talking about. I think that's just at surface level. And I had an old business partner. He'd always say, it's never about what it's about. And I think it's the exact same thing with this social unrest that you're seeing now. I think what it's really about is inflation. You know, what you hit on right at the beginning of the interview, where prices go up at 20%, but wages only go up by 6% or 10%. And you compound that over 4 or 5 years and people can't put food on the table. They can't put a roof over their head unless they get more and more handouts from the government. And, you know, that puts them in a mental state that I think is far more unhealthy. And you take away their hope and kind of this is the powder keg you get.
Exactly. Powder keg is a perfect way to describe what I was trying to say earlier. And yeah, I was thinking about it earlier, like anyone in the 80th percentiles, you know, if you have a solid income at, you know, and you have a solid investment portfolio, times like this probably aren't that bad. You can definitely get through this because you've got it goes back to financial freedom, creating your own financial freedom, creating a situation where you don't have to succumb to the result of what the government is doing or, you know, not doing in some cases. But for a lot of people below that line, yeah, I can only imagine that it's pretty brutal. It creates a lot of pressure at home when you can't pay your bills or feed your kids or send them to the right school or get a car to get to work or whatever it might be. You know, it's really tough. And that's why inflation, I think, is, I'm surprised that when Trudeau, speaking of Canada, you know, basically stands up and says, well, look, we're going to spend as much as we need to spend. Like, we're not going to tighten our belts here, guys. Let's not do that. Let's not take our heroin addicted economy off the heroin. Let's keep going.
Yeah.
And I'm really surprised that people aren't really angry about that. You know, it's totally, if you ran a business that way, where you just borrowed money all the time to keep your business growing, but inevitably you have to pay back all this debt or face the reality of mismanaging your business, you know, you couldn't do that. It just doesn't work like that. It's not responsible, but yet the government can do it and we allow it to happen. And that's.
So did you guys have the stimulus checks up there in a version of the PPP loans, like with it, that went out to, you know, basically any business that had a couple of employees got a $500,000 check?
I can't speak to the amounts because I didn't apply for one personally, but I do know that there were stimulus checks given to small businesses, large businesses, and to individuals. I remember sitting at the golf course one day having lunch with my wife again, and there was a table of four guys that had just finished a round, and three of the four guys were receiving these stimulus checks. It's like a Tuesday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They should be working, and yet they're playing golf laughing about the fact that they got stimulus checks.
Yeah.
And again, I left, I was just mad. I was like, yeah, well, great. Well done, government. You know, we're not incentivizing people to work harder.
The opposite.
Yeah. Like you talk about productivity.
Not to produce goods and services.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
I had a text from my sister the other day, basically same thing, where she was at her golf course and she talks to all the people out there. And there's a lot of business owners. Mm-hmm. And this is in Dallas, Texas. And she said that literally every single person she knows that owns a business got a PPP check.
Yeah. It's like, well, why wouldn't you?
Yeah. I mean, I had this conversation last night on my live stream because I don't want to condemn anyone or throw them under the bus for taking the PPP check because they're a taxpayer. So
right.
I think it's rational to make that decision. But from a personal standpoint, I didn't do it from a position of principle, because I don't agree with the program and therefore I'm not going to participate in it. Even if I were to get an extra, you know, free quote unquote, $500,000 or $1 million or whatever I would have received. But I think that has had a substantial impact on the supply shortages and the increased levels of demand that you normalize, that you normally would not see in a recession. You would see demand go down, not up.
Exactly. We've seen a huge increase in the price of houses in Canada. As it's like a strange side effect. People weren't spending money. They were receiving money from the government and saving more money than ever. And then all of a sudden they're out shopping for houses. So the housing prices in Canada have just ballooned. They were already in a bubble.
Already sky high.
In Vancouver and Toronto was like very well-documented bubbles. And so that's just continued through Canada. And it's funny, I was talking to a client of mine about this as well. And he's a US-based, they produce steel products. So they produce like the front of snow plows, for example, you know, like the thing that actually pushes the snow made of steel.
Yeah.
And I said, Ted, like, and they produce knives and all kinds of stuff. And I said, Ted, like, how's business? He goes, business is great. He goes, I can't find any employees though. I said, well, what's the issue? He goes, the federal government's my biggest competitor right now. Yeah, right. They're paying people more money to stay home than I can afford to pay them to come and work on the line. So, you know, coming, you know, from the horse's mouth, it's, these are real life examples of business owners that can't find employees. It's interesting. They want to pay them. They want
Mark,
to.
Let me try something that I don't usually do. So, editor, just, be on high alert here. But I think I'd love to get your opinion on this. I'm going to try to do a screen share. This is a chart that my good buddy Joseph Wang introduced me to. Mm-hmm. And so what it does is it breaks M2 money supply down even further. So this is the household and nonprofit checkable deposits in currency. So it's basically what it's doing is it's taking the average Joe and Jane and saying, okay, how many dollars do they have in their checking account in aggregate total? And we can see here prior to 2020, it was right around $1.2 trillion. As we speak today, it's $3.6 trillion, an increase of $2.4 trillion from a base of $1.2 trillion, and let's call it a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So when you give people that many dollars, you're going to have shortages and you're going to have significant amounts of inflation. And Joseph attributes this rise directly to the stimulus checks and the PPP loans.
Yeah, that chart looks identical to a chart I was looking at just before this interview, which is the Fed's balance sheet. It is the exact same chart, basically. And that correlates, that also correlates with the S&P 500. It correlates with, you know, it.
And crypto market cap.
Exactly. So, you know, this is an excellent chart. And it's funny, talking about supply chains, I heard this somewhere else, but it really stuck with me. It's like, you know, after the buzzword was transitory at the beginning when they talked about inflation, now the buzzword has kind of become supply chain issues. So yes, you've pointed out a good fact that they in fact are creating this huge amount of demand, which is stressing the supply chains. But when you look back like 18 months, you know, these supply chains that took decades to optimize, all these trading routes that were happening, global trading that was happening, these are all optimized. And about 18 months ago, the government, for better or for worse, now they had their reasons, but they enforced government mandated lockdowns, effectively breaking all these supply chains that took decades to set up and to optimize. And now they go, well, just leave it to us. We're going to help fix these supply chains. You know, our regulatory bodies, our government agencies are going to get involved and we're going to fix these supply chains. I'm like, seriously, you broke them.
Yeah.
Now you tell us you're going to fix them. You know how long it's going to take a government agency to fix something that the free market could fix on its own? I mean, it's.
No, what's so, gonna, yeah. Market's easy. What they're going to do is they're just going to let DMV handle the problem. They're going to get all the people at DMV and say, hey, go fix those supply chain issues really quick. All right, man, let's get back on topic with gold here. I listened to a Macro Voices episode the other day with Russell Napier, and they were talking about gold. Russell and my good buddy Eric Townsend, and Russell had a very interesting take regarding the supply side of gold that I hadn't really heard. And he was talking about how he thinks in the future this ESG movement that now includes coal and maybe oil, nat gas, he thinks it's going to expand and become more broad to also include mining of precious metals. So he thought this could be a very strong bull argument as far as lack of capital going into find new mines or maybe to get more gold out of the ground from existing mines because of a perceived negative effect to the climate, carbon emissions, what have you. And therefore, that could really restrict the supply of gold moving forward. So if demand stays the same or increases because of this, we'll just call it money printing to use that term loosely, that could set up an environment where gold spikes higher, similar to what we've seen with coal or maybe net gas in Europe. Do you have any thoughts on that?
That's really interesting. And I heard you speak about that recently as well. And it the timing of you speaking about it and the timing of someone coming to our company and speaking to us about it was almost identical. Just a few weeks ago, we had a keynote speaker come and speak to our staff about responsible mining and responsibly sourced gold. Because, you know, this is something that happened in the diamond industry as well. a number of years ago where, you know, Blood Diamonds, they made the movie with Leonardo DiCaprio, and then there was like a huge social uproar. And this same trend is now happening in the gold space. And it actually kind of ties into what you're talking about. Some of the largest buyers of gold on the planet are jewelers, you know, the Cartiers of the world. These are gold and silver buyers. Tiffany's, for example, these guys buy in, you know, tonnage every year for their production. And they've already gone to the major refineries like Pam Swiss, for example, which is the keynote speaker came from Pam Swiss to talk to us. And they've gone to Pam Swiss and said, we will only buy gold from you that's mined from mines in Canada, for example, in the United States, where mining practices are at a much higher standard, but the cost to mine
is higher
and the capital required to mine in those places is much, much higher than it would be in West Africa, for example,
right?
Where a lot of traditionally where a lot of gold supply goes to Europe and to the European refineries. So those big buyers have already started that trend, and the refiners are already creating the processes, including the use of the blockchain, to be able to prove to them that the gold is sourced from these mines. So it ties exactly into what you're saying now. He said the effect will be, I don't know about the effect on the spot price. You're probably right. The theory sounds good, but he said the effect on premiums for gold will be driven up, because obviously there's more of a cost to source and produce these goods for the refiner than there would have been previously, where they could just take gold from anywhere, the cheapest gold on the market, to do it. So he said, expect premiums go up, and he said, expect this trend to continue in your market, in the gold market. So it sounds like finally us gold guys are going to have to get with the times and modernize and probably pay more just like investors will for gold and silver.
What's the current production price on gold and silver? I know that's a really tough question because it's so broad, but maybe for that producer that you're talking about in Canada or the United States.
It varies. It can vary from mine to mine, obviously, and from region to region. And I'm not a mining expert, so I don't want to misquote. So I'm probably not the best guy to ask what current mining costs are in gold. I'm on the other end of the gold spectrum, at the other end of the supply chain, so to speak. So,
okay.
I know that it's definitely a profitable undertaking at the prices that we're seeing right now. There's definitely nobody who's losing money at $1,800 an ounce.
Or $24-$25 silver, same thing.
Definitely profitable for the mines, certainly. Yeah, there's going to be more exploration at these prices, definitely. And supply is being flat, you know, very stable. Supply for gold and silver is stable from year to year. So it's really external factors on the demand side that will create, you know, a bull market for gold or a bear market for gold or silver.
Okay. So what do you think about the argument that crypto, or let's say Bitcoin more specifically, is taking capital away from gold? And if Bitcoin continues to do well, then that's kind of this kind of zero sum game mentality that if crypto is doing well, then gold has to do poorly.
Yeah, what a great question. And first, I have to start by saying I invest in crypto as well. So I'm a gold guy, yes, but I'm also a crypto guy. So I sleep well at night knowing that I own both. They actually, in my mind, they provide me with two different things. Crypto is kind of like an option on the future. Gold is like an option on the past and 6,000 years of civilization. It's trusted, it's well-established, it's so ingrained in our society and our cultures. I don't think that's going away. So I don't think it's ever going to become a zero-sum game. Not to mention that central banks hold a lot of gold, and that isn't a position that they're going to give up easily. I mean, that's a bargaining chip at a very high level for these central banks and for countries when they go to the negotiating tables. But to answer your first question, is capital that previously would have found its way into the gold market going to crypto? Absolutely. Nobody can deny that. You know, it's true for guys like myself who sit on both sides of the fence, who invest in gold and invest in crypto. I invest less in gold now, probably because I invest a little bit more in crypto. But I think for a smart investor, it's not a zero-sum game. It shouldn't be a zero-sum game. If it is a zero-sum game, you're missing something in the argument. I think that you should own both. And if you look, what I've been doing recently, because I own both assets, as I look at the daily performance of the two, and I was expecting to see them correlate at like a high correlation, they actually tend to react differently to market movements. And I think it's because crypto at this point in time is still for most investors, a speculative investment.
I agree.
And for gold, for most investors, is like wealth preservation. It's not a speculative investment. It's more of a long, mid to long-term investment. So they really play different roles in the markets. They have, you know, people buy them for different reasons. And I think that's still true for most people, even though the media coverage of that battle would have one trying to annihilate the other. I don't really think that's how it plays out in the real markets, though, to be honest.
Yeah. How do you measure sentiment in the gold market or the precious metals market? Because I think that's, you know, going back to our first thing we were talking about, the boat, you know, everyone's on one side of the boat. So when you're investing in stocks or precious metals commodities, you want to be on the other side of that boat. So kind of fade the crowd. So how do you measure sentiment with precious metals so that you know when everyone's on one side of the boat?
Yeah, I mean, the indicators that I'll look at, there's some good studies that come out from the World Gold Council. If you can sign up for the World Gold Council's newsletter, they've got some good data for you, some good, you know, kind of raw data that you can look at. And one of the things that I'll look at is just the ETF inflows and outflows. So they give like a monthly report if there was a net inflow, net outflow from ETFs. ETFs, in my mind, kind of represent with the Wall Street interest, the institutional investor interest in gold and silver. I mean, they're trading futures contracts, they're trading paper contracts. It's not physical gold for the most part that's being traded. There will be some physical gold, you know, offsetting these trades. Maybe not enough to cover all the positions, but that's another conversation for another day. But that's one indicator that I'll look at because that's one large segment of the gold market.
Okay.
Obviously, you have the industrial usage, which is more or less flat. It's pretty stable. So it's not something you have to pay too much attention to. But the other side is physical demand, which, you know, comes from the U.S. Mint, the Royal Canadian Mint. Obviously, our business, we know what physical demand is because that's all we do all day is sell physical precious metals. And I can tell you that ETFs have been net outflow as of late. But on the other side of that is an increase in physical demand. Physical demand since COVID, since that big bull run that gold had in 2020, has remained at about 80% of that level, which is still very, very strong. And in fact, it's interesting, the indicators you can use these days, we use our YouTube traffic, our YouTube video traffic, probably what you recognize as well. When we do almost exclusively videos on gold,
right?
That the viewership for the searching and viewership for videos on gold will increase as market interest in gold increases because people go to YouTube for everything these days.
That's how they get informed. Right? Yeah, I was going to say Google search, but that, I think that's even better.
Yeah, so we've seen almost a double in searches or views on videos in the last 30 days. So another indicator that demand is quite good right now and interest quite good, although gold took a pounding this morning after they announced that Powell would be back for another term. I'm not even sure how that correlates, but...
But how did the views, what were the views when gold was really soaring, you know, let's say 6 months ago, I forgot when it got to its peak, compared to what they were like a month ago? Did the views really go down substantially?
So the peak being spring and summer of 2020, which was like a decade long peak for the precious metals industry.
Yeah, so you're just getting tons of views on your YouTube videos then, right?
You would have seen the volume for not only YouTube videos, but also for trading at about 300% of the normal rate. And then those came down, like I said, those came down to almost pre-COVID levels in the fall and spring of 20 and 2021. Those came down to almost normal levels. And then we saw a little bit of a resurgence recently, which has been reflected in the price. It went back up from like 1730 to like 1870 as a high recently.
That's a really interesting way to do it. In fact, I'd be curious to do the same thing for the channels that talk about Bitcoin or that talked about crypto, because I've got a plugin for my Chrome browser called VidIQ. Mm-hmm. So if I just click on someone's channel or like a video from like my channel, as an example, if you click on this video on the right-hand side, when you're in YouTube, you get all of my channel's statistics. Oh, and you get the statistics from the past month. So you can see if my views are up by 20% or down by 30%. You can see the same thing with the subscribers, the overall views. You can see a lot of data from other people's channels through that. And that would be fun to go through and take like five of the top gold channels and then five of the top Bitcoin channels and kind of measure market sentiment just through YouTube.
Yeah, I think it's a great indicator. You talk about sentiment is what are people thinking about? What are they craving? And content is where they go.
Yeah.
So I think for precious metals, probably the best indicator for a website would be kitco.com, because they attract a huge audience of precious metal enthusiasts and really rank highly in Google searches as well. Like they're top three in most Google searches. So that would be a great indicator for sentiment. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you can go to a website called SimilarWeb, if I'm getting that right, .com. And that'll tell you how many clicks certain websites get per month and like historic trends. So that's a fan. That's the insider tip of the week right there. Good one, Mark. All right, man. In the sake of time, we'll leave it there. Great conversation. For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
Yeah, if they want to find out more about strategic wealth preservation, go to swpcayman.com. We sell precious metals all day. We keep them safe for people all over the world. And it's been a pleasure, George. Always good to see you. I love your work. Keep doing what you're doing, please.
Thanks a lot, man. Great conversation. Can't wait to do it again.
All right, thanks.
Hi, guys. I'd like to invite each and every one of you to the next Rebel Capitalist Live event. If you are a fan of the Rebel Capitalist show, I guarantee you, you will love the live event. The next one is Houston, where you can meet and listen to speakers, all your favorites from the Rebel Capitalist show. People such as Dr. Ron Paul, Chris Cole, Lynn Alden, just to name a few. If you want to check out the rest of the speaker list and find out how you can attend, we'll put a link in the description below, or you can just go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. This is an event where you can learn to build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. But it's not just about building wealth. It's about increasing your freedom and networking with like-minded individuals, fellow rebel capitalists. It's an amazing event. I know you'll absolutely love it. Check out rebelcapitalistlive.com, and I will see you in Houston.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.